Good morning. Our first case for this morning is United States against Anderson. Mr. Handelson.
May it please the court, Robert Handelson for the appellant Anderson. The second argument in the briefs and today also concerns appellant Garrett, who's not here today. There is nothing in Morrison or anywhere else in our law that says a judge has no duty to investigate a potential conflict just because it did not occur in the proceedings before him or her. A conflict...
Tell us what the relation of these state proceedings were to the federal. Do they concern the same matters? When do they take place?
They certainly appear to be. There was a gun charge against Anderson, which and the federal complaint, which was based on the arrest, which the record shows, at least according to the papers, was based on the state charge, gun charge indicates it was on the same day as the officer testified he stopped Anderson because I think a light was out on his license plate. And as far as I can determine from what we have in this record, that the drugs involved in the state charge were the same as were involved in this conspiracy. I think from the documents in the record, as I recall them at this time, there's certainly a prima facie case that the state charges are basically the same as the federal charges. I think the government argued in its brief there were some differences. There was no difference on the gun charge. I think the state charge, drug charge, if I'm not mistaken, was one possession, while the federal charge is a conspiracy. And I believe if we look at the record as a whole, it would the drugs involved in the state charge would be part and parcel of the federal conspiracy.
But Mr. Handelson, I have two broad concerns here. One of them is that it seems to me the logic of your argument really precludes all the time the notion of joint representation, because you, and my second problem is, you are assuming that this initial lawyer breached his duty of confidentiality to Mr. Anderson, talked about things Mr. Anderson might have said to him in confidence to the other defendants, and then we have to go down this fairly long chain of speculation, which begins with a breach of duty. And if there were some inkling in the record that something like that might have happened, perhaps they testify about something that they didn't know about or something, then perhaps you would be right and there would be some need for a hearing, but I don't see how we can assume that the lawyer was misbehaving so badly. That's sort of the package of my first concerns. The second is remedy, because I know that initially your client was seeking dismissal of the indictment.
I'm not asking for that.
But it sounds like you're asking for a hearing, and then what? I mean, suppose the hearing did bear out your worst fears. What would happen?
Well, if I can take the second one first, I think we have to see the evidence. The Morrison case and all the other cases following it that we cited in the brief seem to indicate that the remedy has to be geared toward a particular situation. I don't know what happened here. If Anderson told a state lawyer something, a state lawyer said something to the other defendants, and they revealed that during the proffers, if that happened, the judge may have to order a new trial and say certain people can't testify, certain evidence can't go before the jury. That's what all the other cases seem to say. I mean, we can't really speak about a remedy until we know what happened. If nothing happened, then there is no need for a remedy. But if some confidence was revealed and eventually made its way to the government investigators and they could use that in some way to further the prosecution, I think the judge would have to order a remedy. And the cases cited seem to say that certain witnesses can't testify, certain evidence can't go before the jury. But
if that's it, suppose we accept that. This was a case where the government had really quite a few witnesses, and I would say its evidence was quite strong, even without these two people. So even if you were right that it was an error, and even if the hearing turned out your way, where's the prejudice to Mr. Anderson?
I don't know until we can, I couldn't comment on prejudice until we can see what happened, what was revealed, and what the government did with it. I submit that it's just premature. We'd have to get the evidence, see what happened, and then make a determination from that. As far as your first one is concerned, I know the Federal Defender Program here will not assign one lawyer to represent more than two clients. I think that's the practice in the Cook County PD's office. What happens downstate in these rural towns where there are not a lot of public defenders, you know, it could have just been an economical thing. They handled a routine. They didn't think anything would happen. I don't know. But the cases from the Illinois Supreme Court and this court, we cite one case from this court in our brief that says when a lawyer represents a defendant who wants to go to trial and a defendant who's cooperating with the government, prejudice is presumed.
But, of course, we don't have that.
We don't know.
In this trial, we have a conflict-free lawyer, Mr. Shostak, who's representing them at the federal level. You're a stage before that, because, of course, in a conflict situation, normally it would just appoint independent counsel for everybody, right?
Well, that's probably what the state judge should have done here. But
the federal judge does it, but they don't have the same lawyers.
No. We're not contending that they do. Our position is if there's a conflict, it has the potential of prejudice Anderson, regardless of where it occurred. You can't say as a matter of law, there is no prejudice because it happened in state court before the charges were filed in federal court. I would submit to you that under Morris and under all these other cases, that just can't exist. If there is
if you examine the testimony of these witnesses, is there anything to suggest that they were testifying to something that they could only have learned through the grapevine from Anderson originally?
Well, not in their testimony, but recall, too, that the government standard practice of cooperators is to proffer them. And there could be things said in revealed in the proffer that don't show up in the testimony. And the only way we can determine that, I would imagine, first of all, find out what Anderson told the state court lawyer, what the state court lawyer told the other defendants. But it is possible. The point is, we're not asking for a dismissal. We are not asking for relief. What we are asking for is a hearing to determine what happened. And then we can determine if there's any prejudice, and if there was, what should be done about it. That is all we're asking for, the hearing. I'm sorry the attorney in the district court asked for a dismissal. It was not warranted. And I'm certainly not asking for a dismissal here.
You think the most that would happen then is a new trial? How does one ever purge the taint if the kind of taint that you're talking about occurs?
In the cases we cited that follow Morrison, the judges did it. There's several cases out of the Eighth Circuit. It turns on the evidence. It depends what the nature of the evidence is. And I think before we come to any conclusion of prejudicial, not prejudicial, what the remedy should be, we have to have the evidence. And then we can make a determination.
But is there ever a case where there's a phase where there was joint representation followed by independent representation where the trial court judge in the second part wouldn't have to have a hearing about what the lawyer did in the first part?
The only time I can think of it, I know what happens in the federal defender panel. Sometimes one lawyer represents people at the initial appearance, and a day later they appoint another attorney. I think if it happens right in the beginning, there's no problem. But once we start getting into substantive proceedings, then I think there's a potential problem that has to be looked at.
Now, how far did these state proceedings go?
I don't recall offhand. I think there's a footnote in the initial brief that the last entry was September of 2000, I think. And or 2000. I'm not exactly sure how far they went. I think the motion is item 105 in the record, and they have the half sheets kind of serve as minute orders for the state courts. And I see my time is almost up. I haven't gotten to the other issue yet.
Do you see this as a Sixth Amendment matter, or is this malpractice? What are we talking about here?
Well, I don't want to get into malpractice. I think if something prejudicial happened, there could be a Sixth Amendment problem. On the second issue, I'd just like to briefly state that where you have these side goings on that don't appear to be part of conspiracy, and the conspiracy didn't get the benefit of these goings on in the side, there are multiple conspiracies. The Supreme Court has spoken on that in Sterone. This court did in Johnson and Varelli. And with all due respect to the court, I think the court's latest jurisprudence, more recent jurisprudence on that, has gone beyond those two decisions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hamilton. Mr. Cutson?
Your Honors, may it please the court, counsel. I am Jim Cutchin, and I represent the United States. Taking the issue of the what may or may not have happened with regard to the state public defender first, in addressing some of the court's questions and concerns, I think the problem that is riddled this entire argument is just this is based on entirely on speculation. There was nothing cited to the district court that should have led or would have led the district court to in any way believe that there had been any kind of a violation in the state court. All equally as problematic is also there's a sense that there was something improper in the fact that this attorney was appointed to represent these three people in state court. Remember from the record that we're talking about and that the state charges are discrete cases of possession of methamphetamine that occurred, and one case was possession of a firearm in a vehicle. These happened months apart. There was nothing in the charges or nothing that should have told the court below or the lawyers themselves that these cases were anyway related. Unless and until these cases in the state court system or these witnesses or defendants in the state court system were approached about cooperating in the state court cases, there was nothing wrong with this public defender representing these individuals in state court.
I understand Mr. Handelson making more kind of a structural argument that this is simply too conducive to leakages of information from one defendant to another. And I wonder if you could just address for a moment the Illinois Rules of Professional Conduct. When a lawyer is in a joint representation situation, does that lawyer continue to have a duty of confidentiality vis-a-vis each of the clients?
I believe that he does, Your Honor, but he was not in a situation of joint representation in the state court. These cases were not related in the state court. They did not become related until they were indicted on federal charges. They were not charged with any kind of concerted action, conspiracy, aiding and abetting, any kind of that kind of thing in the state court. It was not until the federal charges were filed.
Well, didn't he jointly represent all these people in state court, though?
He represented them in their individual cases. The cases were not tied together. They were charged months apart.
There was more than one case. Is that right?
They were months apart. One regarding a traffic stop that occurred in June of 1999. One arose from a search warrant that was executed in January of 1999. They weren't in any way factually or otherwise related to the state charges. Now, obviously under federal conspiracy law, they became relevant, and certainly they were related to the charges. And as counsel pointed out, the methamphetamine found during the individual stops did become part of the federal case. But that does not in any way impute unethical conduct or wrongdoing back to the time when this lawyer was appointed to represent the
Judge Gilbert said, well, this whatever happened in a state case, and we're in a federal case, and therefore I don't think we have to address it here or something. I may be doing him a disservice in trying to paraphrase what he said, but do you think that's an adequate way to deal with the problem? Is that too simple, or is that right on target? What's your view?
Well, Your Honor, I would not perhaps characterize the judge's handling of it quite the same way that that you paraphrased it. Obviously, there are things that can happen in state court that would impact the federal prosecution and evidence. The trouble here is Judge Gilbert was not given anything to base that on. If you think for a minute in the context of allegations of Fourth and Fifth Amendment violations, this court has repeatedly required definite, specific, factual allegations of wrongdoing to even warrant a hearing on the issue. That was not done here. Again, it's just conjecture, speculation. Well, he represented him, and this could have happened. Well, that, respectfully, I would submit that such logic, you could carry that to the extreme. Anytime someone wanted to allege some kind of violation of the Fourth or Fifth Amendment, they could allege, well, he could have been coerced. He could have, it could have happened this way. What the defendant could have done in this case, if he had been interested in providing the district court with some basis in which to hold a hearing, he could have pointed to information contained in the discovery. One of the questions asked to opposing counsel was, or his answer to one of the questions was, well, we would have to look at the proffers to see what information was conveyed. As this court, and I'm aware Mr. Handelsman does a practice in the district court in the Southern District, we maintain an open file policy. Counsel has all this discovery. It's both copied and sent to him, and in particular in this case, he was offered the invitation to come to the U.S. Attorney's Office to review the discovery. He could have looked through the proffers. He could have determined whether there was anything, looked through them with his client, which I'm sure that he did because he received these things, copies in the mail, to determine if there was anything that was provided that these witnesses would not have known but for their own participation in these events. I think it's telling, in addition, if we are presuming that this rogue public defender is down there betraying confidences and telling all his clients what everyone else says, how come the defendant didn't make the allegation that I know that this attorney was doing this because he did it to me? He told me what Garrett and Pennington said. That allegation wasn't made. Why are we to assume that he's only telling these clients about telling the clients about what Anderson said instead of the street going both ways?
Has there been any action with the Illinois Disciplinary Board?
I'm aware of none.
Have they initiated any that you know?
I'm aware of none, Your Honor, and I can only, based on my experience in past cases, if any action had been filed, we would have been contacted for our input on what we saw that occurred, and we have not been contacted as far as I know. In addition, to go on to what the defendant could have done in this case to provide a more definite set of facts for Judge Gilbert to consider, he could have...
Can I just interject here? Sure. Would you agree that if there were some sort of threshold showing, then a hearing would be called for?
Certainly, if the facts would warrant it, but again, there were no... Beyond mere speculation, there was nothing provided to the district court. Certainly, he could have...
If you need information that would sort of rebut the presumption that the attorney is acting properly and...
Exactly.
...affecting confidence of his client.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in fact, the cases about disqualification, I would submit, are premised on the presumption that attorneys act ethically. It is because the attorney is presumed to keep confidences that he can't follow lines of cross-examination. Those cases are premised, as this court has premised in other cases, on the notion that attorneys do follow ethical rules. The argument defendant proposes is premised on the fact that attorneys don't follow ethical rules, which I don't think anyone is prepared, certainly I hope, not prepared to accept. Without some kind of evidence to rebut that presumption. Certainly, the defendant could have offered the affidavit, could have sought. There's nothing in the record to indicate that he even sought an affidavit from the attorney saying, yes, I did these unethical acts, and there's no reason to assume that the attorney would have been any more likely to admit those at a hearing than he would have in an affidavit. None of these things were done. Certainly, the defendant bears the burden of convincing the judge that a hearing is warranted, and nothing was done in this case to do that. With regard to the issues of multiple conspiracies, as noted in our brief, this issue was not raised below. There was no instruction tendered to the district court. It is merely a plain error analysis. In the best of circumstances, such an argument, as this court has noted, is a very high hurdle or heavy burden for the defendant to carry. It is akin to a challenge to sufficiency of the evidence, as this court has said, and all reasonable inferences of the evidence presented must be drawn in favor of the government. There was ample evidence in this case that this defendant conspired with the co-defendant Garrett in this case, and that they were at the hub of a pretty large, for our area, methamphetamine distribution and manufacturing ring. The sub-players were certainly spokes to that hub that brought precursor materials to these defendants, along with an unindicted co-conspirator, Ron French, in order to for them to be able to manufacture methamphetamine. The only evidence pointed to by the defendant of which he claims there could have been a finding of multiple conspiracies was the fact that Anderson manufactured methamphetamine with Brian Bulmer, at least attempted to, on five occasions, and Garrett did so with a Bobby Miller one time. Remember, the conspiracy charge here was a two-year conspiracy. I would submit the evidence showed a much longer period of time than that. It is, I think, defies logic to think that in light of the evidence, as the court has already indicated, that was available in this case, that the jury would be in any way confused. In fact, this court in Mims, I believe it was, indicated that multiple conspiracy instructions where defendants are involved in all of the activities alleged, even if it was susceptible to a multiple conspiracy argument, instruction was not required because the evidence was not of such that the jury would be confused about what was charged.
Well, there was a great deal of evidence of individual transactions Anderson had with other people and that Garrett had with other people, but I think the evidence we need to focus on is where were they, what did the jury have in front of it to show that they were acting together somehow?
They had lots of evidence from Wayne Buckley. They had lots of evidence from Deborah Garrett that these individuals were in a constant or repeated activities of manufacturing methamphetamine and that they did so to distribute it to others. Again, as this court has said, not all the participants in a conspiracy have to know each other. They have to be working towards a common goal. Again, what this conspiracy showed was that many people brought precursor materials to these individuals to trade to them for the purpose of manufacturing methamphetamine. The evidence showed that when one was out of methamphetamine, he simply went to the other co-conspirator or had him deliver that to supply to the individual that came to him. It showed repeated transactions, and I don't believe that there was that it's susceptible to a multiple conspiracy instruction. But even if it had been, the law of this circuit is clear that there was no harm here. Again, the defendants were involved in the alleged multiple conspiracies. These defendants were involved in those activities. Also, importantly, the district court's instructions adequately did inform the jury. This court in, I believe it was United States versus Payne, which is 226 F3rd 792, affirmed or held harmless the failure to give a multiple conspiracy instruction when the district court instructed the jury exactly as it did in this case. That is that in order to find the defendant guilty, you must find that he committed the conspiracy as charged in count one. Exactly what the district judge instructed the jury in this case, and I submit that there even if in a likely event this court were to hold that multiple conspiracies were present here, there certainly was no harm, certainly not plain error for the district court to refuse to give the instruction as given. If there are no more questions, I would submit to the court on the briefs. Thank you.
Apparently not. Thank you very much. Mr. Handelsman? You have four more minutes, Mr. Handelsman.
Thank you. I beg to differ with Mr. Cutchin's representation. Under the cases, there is a per se conflict where attorney represents a cooperator and defendant who wants to go to trial. And there's certainly a prima facie showing in this record that that Anderson and the cooperators were represented by the same attorney. Now,
would your allegation here even be sufficient to trigger a disciplinary inquiry by the Illinois, whatever the
ARDC.
Special responsibility?
I don't know. It may very well be. They hold a hearing and get some preliminary facts. They have three levels, and the first level is like a grand jury. They try to find out what happened and then decide if there's a violation. If they feel there's a potential violation, then it goes up to another level where they hold a trial. But at least on the face of, if these cooperators decided to cooperate while they were represented by the same attorney, then there could very well be a problem there.
But then isn't the remedy that the attorney simply withdraws from the representation of all but one, you know, chooses the one that's going to be his client, and the case goes forward? It's the next step that I'm having trouble with, assuming that during the period of joint representation, the attorney is breaching confidences from one client to the other. I don't know why we should assume that.
Well, I'm not asking you to assume. I'm asking you to hold a hearing and find out what happened. I mean, if we start saying you've got to have a showing of this, that, and the other thing, these things aren't always available to the attorney who's filing a motion. He has to have a hearing to find out what happened. Mr. Cutchins mentioned something about open file policy. We know cooperators talk to agents while they're transporting them around, while they're walking from the cell to the prosecutor's office. These things don't always get on paper. But I would submit
to you... How would that be a breach of the attorney-client confidentiality if a cooperator talked to an agent?
Well, by itself, it's not. But if a cooperator told the agent something that the state PD told him, which the state PD learned from Anderson... Well, a lot of that's what happened. That's why we need a hearing, to find out about the ifs. You can't say we can't have a hearing because there are a lot of ifs when there's no way to find out what happened. We're just asking for a hearing to find out what, if anything, occurred. Then we can determine if there's a basis for relief here. On the second issue, I submit to you under Sterone, this issue of multiple conspiracies is not subject to a plain error, harmless error analysis. Sterone was quite definite in saying it's a substantial right, and it cannot be pushed off as harmless error.
You have to show some sort of prejudice, though, don't you?
Not under Sterone. Just said it's not subject to that type of analysis. The Supreme Court used the expression, it's not subject to, I forget the exact language, it's on page 273 of the Supreme Court reporter, but it said something to the effect it's not subject to a harmless error analysis.
Well, these two defendants were at the core of whatever conspiracies were involved, were they not?
Well, as far as the
why should we be concerned with in some instance, they might have been working with one person and another, they're working with somebody else.
Because Sterone says we have to. Sterone treats this as if they weren't appointed counsel, the judge was a former prosecutor, that type of thing. Sterone puts that in the same ballpark. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Handelton, you're serving by appointment, are you not?
Yes, I am.
The court would like to thank you very much for taking the appointment, for your vigorous representation of your client. And thank you also, Mr. Cutchins. The case will be taken.